Schönen Nachmittag bei einer weiteren Folge der Philosophischen Brocken. Begrüßt Sie Herbert Rachowetz. Wir haben in diesem Sommer für die nächsten zwei Sessions eine Dokumentation vorbereitet. Diese Dokumentation schließt an die sogenannten Wiener Kreisvorlesungen, die dieses Jahr zum 17. Male stattgefunden haben an der Universität Wien. Das Institut Wiener Kreis ist ein mit der Universität Wien verbundenes Institut, das auch eine Sommerschule anbietet und das in diesem Jahr Peter Gallison eingeladen hat, einen Professor für Philosophie und Geschichte der Naturwissenschaften an der Harvard University. Der Vortrag von Peter Gallison handelt von einem Thema, das in Wien ganz besonders richtig lokalisiert ist. Er nennt sich The Assassin of Relativity, Friedrich Adler and Albert Einstein. Dazu muss man wissen, dass Friedrich Adler, der Sohn des Parteivorsitzenden der Sozialistischen Partei in der Zeit vor dem Ersten Weltkrieg, Viktor Adler, ein Physiker gewesen ist, der mit Albert Einstein zusammen in Zürich studiert hat, der ihn gut gekannt hat und der besondere Notorität erlangt hat, dadurch, dass er im Jahre 1916 den österreichischen Ministerpräsidenten Graf Stürck erschossen hat in einem Wiener Restaurant, damit zu einem einerseits Staatsfeind und andererseits Helden der linken Reichshälfte geworden ist. Die Vorstellung, die Peter Gallison von Friedrich Adler vermittelt, beginnt mit Zitaten von Leo Trotzki, der beschreibt, wie die Situation in Wien gewesen ist. Im ersten Teil des Vortrags beschreibt Peter Gallison dann auch insbesondere die Motivation dieses Attentats, die darin liegt, dass für Fritz Adler die Militärdiktatur, die Zensur der späten österreich-ungarischen Monarchie nicht mehr akzeptabel war, sodass er ein Zeichen setzen wollte für die ganze Welt, dass hier ein Systemumsturz nötig ist.
In the summer of 1914, Leon Trotzki, then in exile here in Vienna, visited the Socialist Workers' Party headquarters to meet with Friedrich and his father, Victor Adler. In the secretariat, I came across Friedrich Adler, or Dr. Fritz, Trotzki wrote, as he was called in top party circles, thin, of quite good height, slightly stooping, with a fine brow over which his curly, shining hair fell down, and with the imprint of a perpetual thoughtfulness on his face, Fritz always stood as one apart among the quite numerous Vienna party intellectuals, so ready for wise cracks and cheap anecdotes. He had spent a year and a half in Zurich as assistant professor of physics and as editor of the party newspaper Volksrecht. Trotzki continued, the young Adler, with his inimitable revolutionary temperament, disdained the old system of his father, Victor, the eminent psychiatrist and head of the party. The war had split the Socialist Party of Austria into fiercely battling camps of social patriots and socialist internationalists, dividing Adler fils from Adler père. Fritz Adler's deepest criticism, according to Trotzki, his real distrust and hate, were directed at the Habsburg regime. During their last meeting, on the 3rd of August 1914, Friedrich Adler showed Trotzki the government's appeal to the population, hunt the foreigners. Trotzki again, it was with concentrated abhorrence that he, young Adler, spoke of the rising orgy of chauvinism, but his outward restraint merely masked his profound moral shock. Then Victor Adler stepped into the secretariat, suggesting that Trotzki immediately accompany them to the chief of the political police, a measure of the Adler's authority, to find out what the government intended to do with the Russian exiles. In the car, Trotzki gestured to the festive reaction the city had to the beginning of war. Victor responded, "All the unbalanced and all the insane are coming out on the streets. This is their day." War throws open the field to every instinct and every type of lunacy. Ihren Arzt Adler, according to Trotsky, viewed politics, especially, as he often put it, Austrian politics of the day, as a form of psychopathology. Adler apparently had enough clout to get an immediate audience with the police chief, Haya, who told the leftist duo that leaving town would be an excellent idea. "Tomorrow?" Trotsky asked. "No, rather today," Haya responded. "Right now." 3 hours and 10 minutes later, the Adlers had Trotsky and his family on a train for Switzerland. In the run-up to the Great War, Albert Einstein, like Fritz Adler, was resolutely anti-nationalist and anti-war. The two went back as friends to their student days at the Eidgenössische Technische Hochschule, where they followed some of the same courses. Later, the two had flats in the same building on the Musonstrasse in Zurich, just in back of the ETH, when Adler was an assistant professor of physics at Zurich University and Einstein was working at the patent office in Bern. Friedrich Adler wrote his father on 19 June 1908 that living next door in this building is a man named Einstein who studied at the same time as I did. We even heard a few lectures together. Our development is seemingly parallel. He married a student at about the same time as I and has children. But no one supported him, and for a time he half starved. As a student, he was treated contemptuously by the professors. The library was closed to him. They had even competed for a job, for which Adler was briefly favored by some. Fritz denounced himself. "If it is possible to obtain a man like Einstein for our university, it would be absurd to appoint me. My ability as a research physicist does not bear even the slightest comparison to Einstein's." Out of physics, with no other means of support for him and his family, Fritz followed his newspaper stint by a return to party headquarters in Vienna. Adler found himself caught between physics and politics. As for Einstein, he never conformed to the absurd popular picture of him as a head-in-the-clouds apolitical teddy bear, not in his youth, not in his middle age, and not in his last years. In my opinion on the war from late October 1915, Einstein wrote, "I am convinced that it is possible in the near future to form a supranational organization in Europe that prevents European wars, just as now war between Bavaria and Württemberg is impossible in the German Reich." How could it be, Einstein wondered, that an individual, someone who routinely suppressed from all forms of unruly behavior, could commit mass murder? Peering into the mind of the good, well-intentioned citizen with a political, psychological tenor reminiscent of Heinrich Heine, he wrote this, "I see a dimly lit, comfortable space. In one corner stands the pride of the man of the house, a well-tended shrine to the presence of which every visitor is loudly alerted and upon which is written in huge letters, patriotism. It is usually a taboo to open this cabinet. In fact, the man of the house scarcely knows, or not at all, that this shrine contains the moral props of bestial hatred and mass murder, which, in the case of war, he dutifully takes out and uses. This shrine, dear reader, you will not find in my parlor." Einstein continued his personal address to the reader, "You too should put a piano or bookshelf in your mental parlor." As for Einstein, he had no intention, as he said, of making a secret of my international sentiments. The state to which I belong as a citizen has no place in my emotional life. I consider affiliation with the state to be a business matter, somewhat akin to one's relationship to life insurance. To Romain Rolland, Einstein lamented, "I know people in Germany whose private lives are guided by a virtually unbounded altruism, but who are waiting with the greatest impatience for the declaration of unlimited submarine war." Furious as he was at the slaughter of war, in late 1915, as he penned those words about war, Einstein was immersed in the hardest work of his life, modifying and extending the equations of general relativity. In the third week of November 1915, he realized that the theory correctly described the rate of the precession of the perihelion of Mercury, where Newtonian physics could not. Overcome with emotion, he told a collaborator he had the feeling that something actually snapped inside him. A few months later, in 1916, on a very different plane, something snapped in Friedrich Adler. Adler knew that Count Karl Stürg, Prime Minister of Austria, took lunch regularly at Vienna's prestigious Meissel-Schaden Hotel. On Saturday, 21 October 1916, Einstein's parallel life friend positioned himself at a table three over from the count. A woman sat down behind the Prime Minister. Adler waited for her to move. At 2:15, she left the restaurant. and at 2:30, a Browning revolver ready, he paced over to his target's table and put three bullets through the politician's head. Adler yelled, "Down with absolutism! We want peace!" One of the accompanying officers swung his sword over Adler's head. Another ripped off Adler's glasses. I wanted to get out of there alive, not become a lynching victim, and so said, "I'll go before the court." The revolver went off in the fighting. Adler recounted how he'd said, "I'll go with you." Adler's first interrogation, conducting the evening of 21 October, took place at the prison of the Royal and Imperial Police Headquarters in Vienna. About 6 months after the beginning of the war, so about April 1915, Adler told the investigators censorship and the associated legal consequences were getting ever worse. The thought occurred to him for the first time that he might actually act against the military dictatorship through an assassination. "I considered the situation of the population as a true emergency in the legal sense, in the context of which all means could be used. That my party was following a politics of accommodation meant that I saw myself called upon to act alone." So at the end of April 1915, at a gun shop on Zurich's Bahnhofstrasse, Adler bought a Browning pistol with two boxes of ammunition. At first he had fixed his gun sights on Justice Minister Victor Ritter von Hockenberger, who had been formerly responsible for the censorship, and on the Hungarian Prime Minister, Count István Tisza de Borosieno, whom Adler judged to be the true head of the monarchy. But on one hand, he reasoned killing Tisza could have been misinterpreted through the lens of the tensions between Austrians and Hungarians. On the other, murdering Hockenberger, the justice minister, would have been put him in flagrant contradiction to his professed devotion to justice. At the time, Sturg did not enter his plans. As the war worsened, as the pace of censorship began to pick up, Adler related, he began reconsidering the idea of an attack. Still, no single person stood, as far as the populace was concerned, as truly responsible for the actions of the regime. And my party, as he put it, remained committed to a compromise politics. I stood alone in my political interpretation. Over the months preceding the assassination, Count Sturg's stance became ever clearer when he canceled Parliament. At last, Adler noted, the bourgeois parties began to take notice. Even the most absolutely tame actions from the Social Democrats fell under censorship. A meeting for university professors called for 22 October 1916 in the Konzerthaus Saal. The morning, then that was censored. The morning of 16 October, rumors began to circulate that even this professorial assembly would be canceled by the authorities. This, Adler told his police interrogators, could not stand. He began planning the attack. Meanwhile, censorship fell heavily on the Arbeiterzeitung when the paper wanted to publish a piece on the convocation of Parliament. Sturg let it be known that he considered any such attempt to convene a meeting of the party representatives was illegitimate. On Friday, the 20th of October, the ban on the proposed 22 October meeting of professors passed from rumor to edict. Adler got a phone call about noon that Friday, 20 October, telling him the ban was definitely in place. An hour and a quarter later, he went to his father's apartment where he relayed the news. His father wanted to call the prime minister or the governor to get it reversed, a proposal Friedrich told the interrogator he treated with dripping irony. I was convinced that this intervention by my father was hopeless, and it seemed to me quite laughable in light of my inner intentions, about which, of course, I gave no indication to anyone. That same Friday, 20 October 1916, the Arbeiterzeitung had aimed to publish a front-page article titled Censorship. The police blasted the Austrian government. In Germany, the article argued, the Reichstag had debated the problem of censorship many times, not so in Austria. In Germany, the Reichskanzler had specifically ordered that the expression of domestic political matters not be repressed, not so in Austria. For 30 months, emergency powers had prevailed. Worse, on the front page of the Arbeiterzeitung, in the midst of this front and center article on censorship, the censor's hand descended, scratched out the text, leaving its gaping white space. Censorship censored. No one but the editors and writers of the newspaper could know what lurked there behind that white space, what had been torn from the view of their public. Or can we? In the archives of the newspaper, the building that housed the journal almost a century ago, the uncensored version still survives. Here's the article, Die Zensur. And you see the white space where something's been torn out. This was the typical newspaper censorship method of the time because they couldn't reset the type. It was too difficult and too late. So it's this space here. And here's what it says, because there's a copy of it that's uncensored, and then the censored version that was published. It has not been possible to move Count Sturg to comment. He was the originator of this whole system designed to annul freedom of the press. His obsession with censorship, which is a far more weighty question than superficial consideration would have it, triumphed during these 30 months of a state of emergency.
Im zweiten Teil des Vortrags von Peter Gallison, den wir hier dokumentieren, geht es um die Motive, die Fritz Adler bewegt haben, nochmal etwas genauer. Er spricht davon, dass Adler sich im Rahmen des Klassenkampfes als ein Zeuge und ein Opfer verstanden hat. Er berichtet auch von internen Konflikten innerhalb der Sozialistischen Partei Österreichs, die gespalten war zwischen den österreichischen Nationalpatrioten und den Internationalisten. Fritz Adler war auch in einem ausgesprochenen Gegensatz zu seinem Vater, der sich der österreichischen Staatsnation verpflichtet gefühlt hat, was Fritz Adler nicht nachvollziehen konnte. Berichtet wird dann auch von der Gerichtsverhandlung und insbesondere davon, dass Albert Einstein ein Gnadengesuch an den Kaiser persönlich zugunsten seines früheren Studien- und Lehrkollegens abgefasst hat.
Meetings blocked, Parliament dissolved, criticism stymied, and now even the possibility of naming the unnamed censorship was forbidden. In that moment, it became clear that this was it, now or never. This was a moment, this is Adler talking to the interrogator, this was a moment for a visible protest through an assassination. It was from yesterday, Friday afternoon, firmly decided I would shoot Count Sturg. Detailed interrogation began the next day, on Sunday, the 22nd of October. Adler, he hoped that the assassination would turn the European public's attention towards the situation in Austria, that the world would see that the situation there was even worse than in Tsarist Russia. He hoped that his own party comrades would see that their accommodation with the absolutist regime was bankrupt. Above all, Adler wanted those in his own party to support the movement of the masses, to finally show some courage and willingness to sacrifice themselves, to show them that the individual was not defenseless. What do you mean by courage and preparedness for sacrifice? Asked the police interrogator. Adler, I mean by that all those virtues that we demand of soldiers at the front. I want those same virtues on our front, on the front of the class struggle, even if it means dying in the service of the cause. In preparing the assassination, Adler told those questioning him that he fully expected the death sentence. He knew his life was over. But he wanted, through the attack, to stir up members of the party, to get them to demand an end to this war, to insist on a conclusion of peace without the annexation of foreign lands or the provision of war damages. Monday, 23 October 1916. Police, where did your political involvement begin? Adler, it started back in 1885, when his father got involved in politics, and from that time on, Fritz was 6 years old, he never looked back. Every day at lunch, he heard about actions by the officials against the workers. That year, his father had taken him to a march demonstration at the Schmelzerfriedhof and explained to the child what parliamentarianism and the revolutionary struggle meant to him. Some of the demonstrators were arrested. Every year, those demonstrations continued, once the police came and conducted a full search of the Adler home. Adler told the police he was radiantly proud when, as a 10-year-old, his father was sentenced to 4 months of prison for his outspokenness about police excesses during a tramway strike. Occasionally, the son was allowed to sit in the cell with his father. Seeing his father imprisoned again and again for various political agitation, Friedrich told the interrogators he had viewed his father as an absolute ideal, and the courts not as an institution of law, but as a means by which rulers could suppress people. By the middle of July 1914, Fritz told the police questioner it was clear to him that war was imminent. His view was not shared by other senior party members, including Karl Renner, who absolutely denied that hostilities were on the horizon. But events moved quickly, and the hand of Sturg was invisibly visible as critical references to Sturg got pulled from the Arbeiter Zeitung. On the 26th of July, 1914, the party leadership met with their trusted colleagues. The Adlers traveled to Brussels, And for the first time, Fritz saw himself in direct conflict with his father, who wanted to ally himself patriotically with the ruling powers of Austria. Huge demonstrations began forming against the war. Juarez urged the Austrian socialists to militate more against the war, and Fritz reported his shame at their weakness, a shame no doubt redoubled after a young nationalist in Paris gunned him down 5 days later on 31 July. On returning to Vienna, Fritz told his inquisitors that the situation he found even more depressing. From the first day back, he fought with Austerlitz, the head editor of the Arbeiterzeitung, who had suppressed the reports Fritz had sent from Brussels to, Austerlitz said, protect the newspaper. For over a year, Austerlitz and Adler would not speak a word to each other. To Fritz, the leadership, including his father, had become cowards. Adler told the police interrogator back in those days one could see and was repelled by some of the hurrah patriotic excitement in the socialist editorial rooms. In one particularly acrimonious socialist meeting, the leadership tried to eschew German nationalism while remaining loyal to the Austrian war effort. One leader thought the battle should remain against Russian Tsarism. Another thought workers should bolster the war in defense of the Austrian economic region, while Karl Renner himself tearfully spoke for internationalism, only later to reveal that what he meant by this was for the many lands of all Austria. There was no way, Adler insisted, that this war could be defended as in the interest of European democracy. It was against the barbaric Tsarist conditions of Russia and against the democratic West. On 2 November 1916, before the attack, the police pressed him, did you concern yourself with the effect your act would have on your wife and children? Adler replied that he hardly knew how to answer this kind of question. It fell with a similar question the interrogator had posed about Adler's parents. My whole life, he said, I saw my party responsibilities as absolutely primary. And a bit later, if on the day of the attack I thought about my wife and children, I don't remember. I only know that on many earlier occasions, and probably also on that Monday of the attack week, verses of Heine went through my head. Adler then recited from Heine's Book of Songs, where the poet wrote elegiacally of Napoleon's capture in Russia, seen through the eyes of two grenadiers. One soldier said to the other, the play is done, cold death I'd gladly cherish, but ah, I have a wife and son, without me they would perish. The verses Adler recalled were selectively replucked from the riposte of the second grenadier. Who cares for child? Who cares for wife? In my breast deeper longings awaken. Let them all go begging to save their life. The emperor is taken. Adler altered that most famous line, mein Kaiser gefangen, literally, my emperor taken prisoner. After all, Napoleon did not die in Russia. Instead, Adler recalled the line as, mein Kaiser gefallen, my emperor fallen. Adler, quae Napoleon, saw himself already dead. Einstein was worried about Adler's execution. He flipped over the pages of a February 1917 cosmological calculation. And sometime between mid-February and 29 April 1917, composed a letter to the emperor. Under the pressure of an unavoidable duty, I take the liberty of communicating a plea to your majesty. The political murder of which Fritz Adler is guilty shook the well-being of every rightly sensitive person in the deepest way. With not a single word will I prettify this gruesome act. With regard to the psychological situation of the perpetrator, however, it seems to me to have to do with a tragic accident rather than a crime. Few can have known Herrn Adler so well as me. I have known Herrn Adler since we were studying physics together 20 years ago in Zurich. He was for several years still my closest colleague as an assistant professor in physics at Zurich University. We also were at that time housemates. In those years, I took Adler to be a man of the purest character, of an almost unparalleled selflessness. Few people have shown themselves to me to be so unqualifiedly reliable and honest as he. Few have, in such measure, overcome their own desires and devoted their strength to other than personal things. Under these circumstances, I feel an unavoidable duty, if I herewith submit to your majesty, from the bottom of my heart, a plea for you to invoke the law of clemency in the event that Adler is sentenced to death, a valuable life could be so preserved. In May 1917, the Viennese authorities hauled Adler before an exceptional court in Vienna. Of cause célèbre, the courtroom was packed, The windows opened and hundreds hung on every word. In his defense, Adler adduced a wide range of offenses by Sturg, fastening on two. Under the former leader's brutal bureaucratic rule, no one, Adler argued, knew who ruled Austria. Go to a minister, you'd be told it wasn't his department, you had to see Sturg. Go to see Sturg, you'd be sent to the military. He was an opponent one had to battle relentlessly. Second, it was Sturg who had dissolved Parliament, Sturg who had wrecked the progressive road towards democracy that most civilized countries were following. Sturg he judged to be a dead point to be bypassed if Austrian history was to advance. To save his son's life, Victor Adler pleaded for the court to find his son insane. He invoked Friedrich's past history of overwork. He gestured to mental illness found on many branches of the family tree. And Victor hired a superb defense team to demonstrate the incompetence of his son and save him from hanging. Aiding the defense was a testimonial from the Physical Society of Zurich, along with another by Einstein's friend, the physiology professor Heinrich Zanger. Adler's lawyer, Dr. Gustav Hoppner, insisted on the spontaneous nature of these glowing reports, which spoke to Adler's scientific, philosophical, and personal qualities. Spontaneous? Not quite. Barely 48 hours after receiving Friedrich Adler's communication, Einstein intervened. Dear Zanger, Einstein had written, the day before yesterday I got a scientific letter from my old friend Fritz Adler. You surely know what the man has perpetrated. I know you never thought particularly highly of him because of his scientific orientation. Adler was a strong defender of Mach, as we'll come to in a moment, and he knew that Adler considered Einstein to be the foremost representative of Boltzmann, of molecular realism, at work in that day. And Zanger shared this. But as a person, I continue the letter from Einstein, he is an exceptional fellow. And extraordinarily selfless, which has gotten him into this stew, as a matter of fact. My compassion for him has grown so strong that I would like to do something for him. Behind Zanger's spontaneity stood Einstein. During April 1917, Einstein fretted about whether he should submit testimonial to the court. So, in favor of calling Adler sane was the state prosecutor who wanted to hang him, the medical psychiatric panel, which found he was sane, Trotsky and International Left, which wanted it to be a political act of reason, and Friedrich Adler himself, who wanted political credit for having decided, for reasons to end the war, to have killed him. In favor of judging Adler insane was Victor Adler, the nationalistic press, and the social democratic press. The nationalist press wanted him to be a cuckoo who had no political significance, and the social democratic press didn't want to be blamed for one of the Adlers having killed the prime minister. During April 1917, Einstein fretted about whether he himself should submit to the court a testimonial, but decided it could do no harm. I was very glad that now the Adler affair has been taken up with such warmth, Einstein wrote Zanger. Even if the matter only tips the balance slightly, it really is most welcome that our Zurichers can be counted on when there's something decent for them to do. Apparently not all the letters from Zanger had been arriving safely at Einstein's door. Don't seal your letters, Einstein advised Zanger. They are always opened by the military censors. Having decided that his intervention was worthwhile, in April 1917, Einstein also wrote Adler directly in jail. I hope you received my package. I now have an unusual request. When your affair is deliberated in court, I'd like to be summoned there as a witness. You should apply for this. It's not senseless, for under the circumstances, anything that could be connected to clarify things would be worthwhile. Something about would shed light on the character of the perpetrator. How much I would like to discuss the relativity problem with you.
Nach der Darstellung des historischen Umfelds und der aufregenden Ereignisse rund um die Ermordung des österreichischen Ministerpräsidenten wendet sich Peter Gallison nunmehr den theoretischen Hintergründen zu. Er spricht einerseits von Streiks, die zugunsten von Fritz Adler in Österreich organisiert worden sind, aber konzentriert sich dann auf die publizistische Tätigkeit, die Fritz Adler vom Gefängnis aus, er war in Stein inhaftiert, aufgenommen hat. Er hat dort, und das ist nun eine ganz besondere Pointe, einen Kampf, eine Auseinandersetzung mit der Relativitätstheorie Albert Einsteins begonnen. Er ist zur Auffassung gekommen, dass in der Relativitätstheorie ein Fehler steckt und hat darüber publiziert und versucht, Albert Einstein davon zu überzeugen, dass es hier nicht ganz mit rechten Dingen zugeht. Einstein selber hat das zum Anlass genommen, in einer Publikation die Rolle von Fritz Adler als dem Kritikus aufzunehmen, allerdings um besser darstellen zu können, wie nach seiner Auffassung der Dinge die Verhältnisse nun tatsächlich stehen. Kurz gesagt, war der zentrale Streitpunkt jener, dass Fritz Adler ein sogenanntes Preferred Reference System, also einen konstanten Bezugsrahmen und einen privilegierten Bezugsrahmen in der physikalischen Betrachtung festhalten wollte, während das im Rahmen der Relativitätstheorie nicht mehr möglich war.
That discussion was in train. The war, the physics of simultaneity, politics, all fused among Einstein's friends, including the scientist, philosopher, industrialist Walter Rathenau, former head of the War Provisions Board. Rathenau dropped a letter to Einstein just before Adler's trial. Your illustration of the two flashes of lightning in the train really gripped me here. Incidentally, I turn it into two dynamite explosions and a czar train. On 18 and 19 May 1917, Sturck's assassin broke his public silence. Hauled before the Ausnahmegericht, Adler faced a charge punishable by hanging. This is him before the court. Debate was furious. Victor Adler's hope for an insanity ruling had its best chance through the psychiatric report, but the commission found nothing wahnhaftes in the motivation of Adler's act. Adler's fame multiplied. He became a hero to soldiers, militant workers, even to ordinary people laboring in the midst of an unparalleled war and an increasingly destitute Austria. On the day the Adler trial ended, 18 May 1917, an anonymous Viennese lieutenant colonel, prisoner of war in Russia, postmarked a card from Nizhny Novgorod to the Minister of the Interior. Attention! The Austro-Hungarian regime should take notice that the instant the verdict against Adler is carried out, the Austrian Kaiser will pay with his life. Letters poured in, and not just from Einstein and lieutenant colonels. One letter marked 19 May 1917 came to the Meissel and Schaden restaurant and forwarded on to the prisoner. The lady who before the attack was seated behind Count Sturg in the dining room and whom you were so honorable to have protected thanks you hereby in her own and also in the name of her three children. In spite of my silence and deliberation, my presence must have caused you a hard inner struggle. My thanks plays no role in your life. I would forever criticize myself if I had ignored you, and so this letter. Adler replied he was happy she understood that he had avoided trying to hit her. The threatening colonel and grateful lady were not alone in giving voice to their defense of Adler. As the war continued, and continued badly, workers struck all over Austria. On January 22, 1918, a police telephone report registered a strike in Bezirk Baden. The governor's office reported, from a good source, the workers want to go to the emperor to procure the release of Friedrich Adler so he can go to Brest-Litovsk to bring the peace negotiations to an end. That same day, 4,000 strikers demonstrated with pleas to free Adler. Elsewhere, 2,000 to 3,000 people gathered to hold signs high for an annexationless peace for bread and for a free Friedrich Adler. Between November 1917 and November 1919, without any question of Einstein and Adler, it was Adler who was better known throughout Europe. In jail, Adler found that many of the guards were sympathetic enough to allow him far more paper books and articles than any ordinary prisoner. So he got moved then to Stein und Gattano. You all know this better than me. This is part of the active prison now that's still in more or less the form that it was in then. He gave notes to his various visitors about what he needed, including his more than friend Sophie Lassosfeld and her son, the future sociologist. First, he assembled a book from his papers on Ernst Mach, Karl Marx, and Engels titled Ernst Mach's Conquest of Mechanical Materialism. Some of this material dated back from teaching epistemological introduction to the foundations of physics in Zurich from 1907 to 10. The work defended the phenomenological unity of science from a Machian perspective and against Max Planck's reductivism. Other parts extended Mach's argument that physics was most importantly about the evolution of concepts, not the erection of a systematic structure. But Adler's Machism went deeper than any particular doctrine. He identified with Mach, idealized him, narrated his own life in parallel with that of Mach. In prison, Adler related how Mach had found his life work launched after reading at age 15 Kant's Prolegomena and its seeming clash with the mechanical materialism of the special sciences. When Adler described his own life work in philosophical physics, he recalled that at age 16, he'd read Engels' lecture on Dering and demanded how Marx-Engels' historical materialism could be squared with scientific materialism. And he effects a kind of a translation that is quite characteristic of a certain form of philosophical Austro-Marxism, which is to take dialectical materialism or the dialectic and to read it as any form of development or historical development, and to take materialism and to read it as Erfahrung, or experience. So dialectical materialism, when it occurs in Marx and Engels, is immediately presented by Adler as historical materialism. Adler took the great contribution of Marx and Engels to have been the shift from a static, dead metaphysics of isolated entities to a living dynamic of process. Means of production, classes, laws, economics, all were continually changing according to patterns that could be grasped. A decade after their groundbreaking work, Adler points to Darwin's parallel material processual analysis of the organic world in concert with the evolving state of the Earth's surface. One decade after Darwin, Adler added, Mach entered the scene, providing an analysis of physics that was fundamental, critical, science as an historically evolving set of concepts as tools, not a final systemic theory with a death grip on the physical sciences. These three historical material analyses, according to Adler, formed an essential triumvirate. It was not for Adler a matter of generalizing the Marxist analysis to other domains, but instead of recognizing that these three domains, Marx, Darwin, Mach, functioned all at the same level, the level where experience prevailed over ideas and the way where developmental structures prevailed over the static. This, for Adler, was the new historical critical Weltbild. Nothing captured better the accomplishment effected by Mach, so said Adler, than his Copernican revolution in the understanding of mass. The Newton tradition had wanted to define mass as the quantity of matter, and bodies through their arrangement of this abstract, inalterable, and fundamental set of atoms that existed below the level of any possible experience. Mach had argued that this had to be flipped on its head, start with perceptible bodies, and then deduce what one could about all the rest. So to define the relative mass of two objects, for example, Adler says what Mach wants to do, is to set two bodies out and to see their relative acceleration towards one another. Here was the perfect, indeed the guiding example of Mach's achievement, according to Adler, a critical historical analysis of a fundamental scientific concept, namely mass, and its radical reformulation, putting experiential bits first, how much each accelerates, while consigning purely metaphysical pseudo-concepts, inalterable, invisible atoms, to the flames. As he completed these prison pages, Adler pushed on the Mach solution to a host of problems. How were the object and subject constituted from bundles of experiences, for example? But if he was really going to press Mach full on into Kantian territory, he needed a Machian analysis of space and time. So he turned to Einstein, his old friend, housemate, and fellow student. Then an explosion. Adler to his wife on the 14th February 1917. I am suddenly a physicist again. I have made a discovery that one would not be overestimating if one described it as the greatest possible in the current state of physics. I awoke Saturday with the solution to a small problem which has bothered me for more than a year, namely the Foucault pendulum problem. In the course of working through the consequences of my little insight, I have arrived at a generalization of Newtonian principles, an elementary law which up till now has simply been overlooked. It would, Adler believed, give clarity to all questions of mechanics and thermodynamics. A few days later, he wrote to say his trial had been postponed until after Easter, a good thing since he was very satisfactorily plunged deep into physics. It has come unexpectedly to pass that I have found a decisive criterion in relativity theory that rules against Mach and Einstein and for Lorentz. It puts everything in a new light. Or as he put in a letter to his parents, what Mach searched for, I have found. Like all great discoveries, it was simple, full of consequences. Friedrich Adler's Neo-Machian discovery opened for him a new campaign. For Victor Adler, it launched a second front on which he too could fight to have his son declared insane. The insanity of opposing Einstein on relativity. By mid-February 19, the father sent copies of this manuscript all over, including to Philip Franck, who wrote back and said, you know, basically, we're in a jam here because we really like Friedrich Adler and we support him, but unfortunately, the manuscript's not insane, it's just wrong. By mid-February 1918 in prison, Adler was correcting proofs for his book on Mach, and he wrote to Mach's son and sometimes collaborator, Ludwig. I have been occupying myself exclusively with Einstein's theory of relativity and hope soon to have a publishable manuscript ready. I think that I have succeeded in pointing out Einstein's mistakes so clearly that other people will be persuaded by it. He wanted to know from Ludwig if Ernst Mach had anything on relativity in the just-about-to-be-published Optics that Mach had left unfinished at his death. Ludwig replied that his father had found relativity too unclear to be included. In his time, Ludwig continued, I brought his attention to certain insufficiencies in the Michelson experiment, and my father acknowledged that he was uncertain about it, and I promised him that I would carry out a counter-experiment. The resources are there, only the time and rest are lacking. I, Ludwig, am particularly interested in your, Adler's, objections to Einstein, whose points of view I instinctively oppose. It would be too wonderful if we could experimentally and theoretically throw a bridge across this overgrowth of mere speculation. According to Ludwig, Mach, his father, Ernst, had treated with a gentle irony both ions and the new views of the relativists. Maybe, or so Ludwig cited his father, the whole thing will merely have been an interesting side trip in Extraspaziergang, but even then it will retain something of lasting value. On 6 July 1918, Adler wrote Einstein, Dear friend, it's been almost 1 year since I wrote you, but I have been thinking of you incessantly, for I was occupied the whole time with relativity theory. I know that you're so convinced of the correctness of your foundations that you do not expect anything from further discussion of it, and yet I would like to burden you with the perusal of my book, for I imagine now having really caught Ariadne's thread, leading to a compelling derivation of the necessity for a preferred reference system from your transformation experiments, equations. Simple diet, good air, quiet solitude, death row agreed with him. In virtually all respects, I'm doing better here than in Vienna. In short, in this topsy-turvy world we now live in, it is considerably nicer intramuros than extra.
Es geht jetzt noch weitere Details aus der Fachdiskussion zwischen Einstein und Fritz Adler, das Zwillingsparadox, die Konzeption von Fritz Adler, der drei verschiedene Zeitbestimmungen für notwendig gefunden hat, lokale Zeit, dann eine Zeit der Zeitzonen und die Systemzeit und nochmals den Bezugsrahmen, den Reference Frame, der nach Fritz Adler doch privilegiert für die Erde sein sollte. Am 1. November 1918 mit dem Zusammenbruch der österreichisch-ungarischen Monarchie wird Adler freigelassen und unter großem Beifall der Sozialistischen Partei beginnt er wieder seine politische Tätigkeit. Diese Tätigkeit wird ihn zur zweiten Internationale führen. Er wurde von Lenin und Trotzki auch eingeladen zur dritten Internationalen, hat aber dort abgelehnt und auch seine Erfahrungen mit der zweiten Internationale sind gemischt. Er ist dort ausgetreten und hat in seiner internationalen Tätigkeit zwischen der zweiten und der dritten Internationalen einen nicht sehr glücklichen Part gespielt.
Back to Adler's salvo of 20 September 1918. The upriver theorist turned clocks and the twin paradox, as it came to be called. You can see that I did not overlook your standard clock. Rather, it is the actual point of departure of my reflections. This is Adler and Einstein. I have been making a serious effort for a year to understand it, but an insurmountable logical contradiction in your assertion remains for me. Adler, one twin rotates with the Earth. Adler, one twin rotates with the Earth, comes back, the other remains still. Each looks the same to the other, yet the clocks are supposed to be different. Einstein stood his ground. Only if the two reference systems, one at rest and one in rotation, were both justified systems in the sense of the special principle of relativity, is equivalent to inertial frames, would there be a contradiction with the special principle of relativity. They are not both justified, however, because K prime is not a Galilean acceleration-free reference system. Only when general relativity is taken as a basis are both frames of reference equivalent. In this case, the difference in the rates of the clocks is explained by the combined effects of the influence of the velocity and the gravitational potential. Nowhere is a contradiction evident. Provoked by Adler, Einstein spelled out a general relativistic account of the twin paradox. So Adler's basic idea was this. He thought there were three kinds of time. There was local time, Ortszeit, that was analogous to the time along a longitudinal line on the Earth. Physics could make the second was a zoned time, where, for instance, within a region like Central European time or Eastern Standard Time, you coordinate all the clocks. And then there's system time, the coordination of the whole world or universe. For physics, the system time was all inertial reference frames. And Adler's view was that Einstein had a local time and a system time, but ignored the fact that there were somehow zones of equivalent times. Let me explain what I take him to mean. But first, Adler says, Adler understands a lot about Einstein's theory. He understands the importance of the law of the composition of velocities. He's absolutely opposed to the ether. That he's not an ether theorist at all. He thinks on Machian grounds one should have no ether. He's hostile to a lot of the program for the interior structure of the electron that was preoccupying much better physicists like Poincaré or Boucherer or Abraham, Cohen, many others. So he understands a lot about what Einstein's doing, and he even understands the importance of the coordination of clocks by saying that Einstein had actually improved on the way that clocks were coordinated in everyday life. Instead, Einstein had said, exchange a light signal with a distant clock, take the round-trip time, and use half of that to set the clock of the distant clock from your starting clock. And in Ortszeit, Zonenzeit, Systemzeit, his prison book, he compares all these different systems. So Adler understands that Einstein does not see any inertial frame being any better than any other one, any more privileged than any other one. And Einstein responds and says, look, the situation is this. We know from Michelson and Michelson-Morley experiment that the Earth is not moving through the ether. And we know that through the Fizeau experiment that we can't see the Earth as dragging the ether sufficiently to explain this. So the Earth is neither moving through the ether nor carrying it along with it. And Einstein says, forced by these two constraints, or pushed by these two constraints, we conclude that there is no privileged frame, no ether, and nothing picks out a privileged frame of reference. And then this is the argument that he has with Adler about these privileged, different frames. Adler says, what if you take the point of view of clock one, well, eins, then U2 is moving, but if you take the point of view of U2, then U1 is moving. How can these not be equivalent? And Einstein says, they're not both physically equivalent because acceleration is something that needs to be taken into account, and special relativity doesn't allow you to reason the way you're reasoning. Adler claimed Einstein had generalized too quickly, and instead he should have said the only thing that's really equivalent is a frame moving, say, at V in this direction and at minus V in that direction. And so there were pairs of equivalent frames of reference, but that different velocities could not be compared. So he thought there was, for velocity at V1, there would be a zone of V1 and minus V1, and for V2, there'd be V2 and minus V2. So you had these zones of opposite moving frames, and they were equivalent. Here's his big pièce de résistance. He says, imagine that you have 2-meter sticks, T, identical in all respects, and their contacts at the points S. On the left, you have a galvanometer, and on the right, you have a battery. Now, if you stuck them together, you would see a deflection. as you see, for instance, in the lower right. Now Adler says, imagine that they're moving with respect to one another up in the upper right, for example. If you take the point of view of the galvanometer stick, then there's a contraction in the battery stick, so they don't make contact and the galvanometer is not deflected. However, if you take the point of view of the battery, then the galvanometer stick is shrunk and it still doesn't make contact. But if you take the point of view that the two come together at opposite speeds, then they make contact and the galvanometer deflects. Now, either the galvanometer deflects or it doesn't deflect. That's not a frame-specific result. So he concludes that all the frames that are not equal and opposite are in some sense irreal, that they're a wrong application of the equivalence of frames. So he takes there to be one privileged reference frame K that organizes every other reference frame into these pairs. Adler concluded, relativity is smashed. The galvanometer will say that the two relativity theorists, both Einstein and Lorentz, are wrong, and neither of the two slabs has really contracted. Bang! Einstein's relativity theory dead. This time, Adler's target did not drop. Your bias for absolute time or for the instantaneous signals exposing itself, Einstein replied, under no circumstance will the current flow if the contacts made are so brief that their duration is small against the propagation time of light or of an electrical wave between the two contact points. The very next day, Einstein wrote again to Adler, telling him he was thinking of writing a dialogue on the paradoxes of relativity, obviously modeled on Galileo's two-world systems. You have provided a particularly suggestive form for one paradox with your example of the rods equipped with contacts. Einstein asked Adler if he, Einstein, could include Adler's galvanometer in the dialogue between an anti-relativity critic called Criticus and a defense advocate, relativist, that he was composing for Die Naturwissenschaften. Bullet deflected, its lead recycled as movable type pro causa. Einstein said, in fact, Adler, here's another paradox for you, one that you might like, given your other one. Imagine that you have two rods that are shaped like this, two pipes that are shaped like this, and they can rotate like that. If you take the point of view of the blue rod, and they're moving towards one another, they take the point of view of the blue rod, then the red rod shrinks, and you could flip it to be entirely contained within the arms of the blue rod. However, if you take the point of view of the red rod, then the blue rod shrinks and be contained in the red rod. So Einstein says, isn't that a paradox? Well, no, it's not a paradox. It depends on the relativity of simultaneity, and if you work out the problem carefully, you'll see that what's considered simultaneous, and therefore what's considered contained in what, depends on your frame of reference. And he wrote this up and published it. He received it shortly before the 20th of October and published it at the end of November 1918. Here's the kind of way the dialogue, and it very much follows the argument that he's really been having with Adler. Criticus, but isn't this gravitational field only fictitious? Its existence is, I should say, only stimulated by the choice of coordinates. After all, real gravitational fields are always generated by masses and cannot be made to vanish by a suitable choice of coordinates. How should one believe that a merely fictitious field could influence the rate of clocks? Relativist. The distinction of real versus non-real is not very productive. With respect to K prime, gravitation exists just like any other object. No one doubts the existence of kinetic energy, even though frame dependent, better inherent in system versus independent of the system. So if you take a cannon and you shoot it, or a bullet, maybe more to the point, and you ran alongside it so it had no velocity with respect to you, it would have no kinetic energy. So kinetic energy depends on frame. Therefore, one can say the gravitational field at a location, one cannot say that the gravitational field at a location is real, nor that it is fictitious. Relativist. But all stars in the universe can be thought of as taking part in the generation of the gravitational field because they are, during the accelerating phases of the coordinate system K prime, accelerated relative to the latter and thus can induce a gravitational field just as well as accelerated moving charges induce a magnetic field. This is Einstein actually at his Machian high point, but... Criticus, will someone make use of the possibility offered by the theory of relativity to relate the movement of the celestial bodies of our solar system to a geocentric system of coordinates? Could such a coordinate system really be considered at rest when relative to the fixed stars So if you took a fixed coordinate system relative to the Earth, so as the Earth turned, you'd conclude that the stars had horrendous velocities. And Einstein replies, well, it may not be convenient, but you can't say it's not a valid system within general relativity. Criticus. People like me have quite often expressed their various doubts about the theory of relativity in journals, but rarely has one of you relativists responded. We do not want to go into the reasons for this neglect, whether it was arrogance, a feeling of weakness, or laziness. This is Einstein writing, right? Criticus then imagines two identical clocks, U1 and U2, separate. He imagines the twin paradox again, and Einstein then goes through and explains how to use the general theory of relativity in qualitative terms to explain the twin paradox. Relativist, your last assertion is, of course, incontestable. But the entire line of reasoning is not legitimate because, according to the special theory of relativity, the two coordinate systems are not at all equivalent systems. One rests, the other accelerates. Criticus, I see you have diffused my objection, but I must tell you your argument leaves me more convicted than really convinced. If anyone anywhere in the world was more convicted than convinced, it was Friedrich Adler, locked in an Austrian prison in late October 1918. By then, the imperial armies were on the run. Einstein wrote to Adler on 20 October, wondering, who between us will be the first to manage to come and see the other? Who can know? Within days, the emperor was urgently pleading for assistance. The social democrats were hovering above the levers of power. Desperately, the old council of ministers offered amnesty for all political prisoners. Friedrich Adler emerged from the Stein Fortress on 1 November 1918 and was immediately greeted as a hero of the working class, not only in Austria. That said, it took extraordinarily little time after his release for Adler to clash with his father's moderate positions. It was their last battle. Victor died 9 days later. Writing about the need for a national assembly on 13 November 1918, Einstein wrote, "All true Democrats must be vigilant lest the old class tyranny of the right be replaced by a new class tyranny of the left. Do not be lured by feelings of vengeance to the fateful view that violence must be fought with violence, that a dictatorship of the proletariat is temporarily needed in order to hammer the concept of freedom into the heads of our fellow countrymen. Force breeds bitterness, hatred, reaction." Despite increased doctrinal tensions, in January of 1919, Lenin and Trotsky offered Adler the position of honorary secretary to the Third International. He refused. To Lenin and Trotsky's dismay, Adler did worse. He joined the center-right Second International as it met in Bern in February of 1919, only to split with them because they purged the Bolshevists. Oh, this is his cell. Or not his cell. This is a cell that's been preserved from the time of Adler. I actually can't figure out which cell in Stein he was in. And here's Adler addressing one of those meetings at the Second International. And then he fought, you know, he denounced the Stalinist trials in 1931. He exposed as a fraud many of their accusations. He wrote about the witchcraft trial in Moscow, and so on. He joined the center-right international to split with them. In short order, he had created the political parallel of his privileged frame of reference where he could follow no laws but his own, dubbed caustically the Second and a Half International.
Um den gesamten Vortrag von Peter Galison, The Assassin of Relativity, Friedrich Adler and Albert Einstein, dokumentieren zu können, nehmen wir zwei Sitzungen der philosophischen Brocken in Anspruch. Wir sind heute so weit gekommen, dass wir das allgemeine Bild, das hier entworfen worden ist, wiedergegeben haben. Es fehlt noch die Schlussfolgerung, die Peter Galison systematisch und historisch aus seinen Überlegungen zielt. Und es fehlt auch die Diskussion, in der einige sehr leuchtende Bemerkungen gefallen sind. Wir werden diesen Teil, den restlichen Teil, in der nächsten Sendung der philosophischen Brocken dokumentieren. Danke fürs Zuhören. Und einen schönen Nachmittag wünscht Herbert Rachowitz.